All right. So for the sake of the tape library, I'm going to say my name is Anne-Marie Russell, and you're at the first session of Writing in the Margins this week. Thank you for coming. I'll admit that it's a bit daunting to think about developing our thoughts as writers in 5 one-hour sessions for 1 week. Anybody who likes to write or knows anything about writing knows that it's sort of a lifelong process and that there's lots of time required in that. So what I'm hoping that we'll do for these 5 days, and I hope you'll come back and come to some of the other sessions. I know that sometimes they conflict with other things you might want to do, but I hope that we'll spend some time kind of considering kind of writing and what kind of the power that writing has for us as human beings, perhaps as people of faith, and then also give us some time to have a little bit of quiet and do some writing, and then if we're willing to share some of what we've written. So no one is going to be required to read anything or share. You're not even required to write. You could just come and sit and be here, but I hope that you'll consider doing that. If things progress, I'm hoping perhaps later in the week we could even do some kind of an open mic for the village and the community, so staff and other folks who aren't part of these classes could come and join us as well. So my name is Anne-Marie Russell. I like to say that I have a love affair with words. So next to my family and the things I believe, words are the things I love most in the world. And so in my professional life, I lived that out as a professor of English at Trinity Lutheran College, which was formerly the Lutheran Bible Institute of Seattle. We're a small college in Everett, Washington. So there I teach writing classes, both composition and creative writing, and I direct the Writing Center, and I'm also newly the Director of Academic Advising. So I work closely with students in writing and also in just helping them plan for college. And in other parts of my life, I'm a singer-songwriter. So I write music and I sing and play guitar and just released my third CD in March. And my CDs are actually in the bookstore, available for sale. And I'm doing a concert on Wednesday night with my brother Nathan, who's the village musician, the trumpet player, and he actually worked closely with me on my newest album. So we're gonna be doing a show, sharing some music. So I also am a blogger. I write on a blog regularly that's sort of widely read by, who knows, a group of people, just kind of my thoughts on life and parenting and living. So anyway, I'm really happy to be here with you. I don't stand here as the expert on writing, and I think—
So you're a mom.
I am a mom, yes. And so, yes. Yeah. So I'm married. This is my husband Aaron sitting here in back. And we have 2 birth children, Maya, who is 6, and Samuel, who's 3. And we're adopting a baby from China right now. So that's our other new exciting thing, probably within the next year or year and a half. So, yeah. So I write as a mom, too, doing things. So one of the things that I love about Holden is the way that we can kind of— Holden really encourages us to get out of kind of a traditional linear way of looking at things and to kind of stand outside and to reconsider and to question and to wonder. And so I've entitled this session or these group of sessions, Writing in the Margins, Stories from a Fringe Landscape, hoping to look at different types of writing, maybe from a new lens or a new perspective. And so today we're just going to look at what it means to be a writer and what it means to write in the margins, how we stand in the margins and what kind of perspective we might have from that. I like the image of a book. You have the main text, but then we have all this space around the text. And if we're sort of writers who get into the text, we write notes in the margins. But sometimes the margins stay blank, and sometimes it's those spaces outside of kind of a traditional narrative, linear text, that tell us a lot about something. So that's kind of what I'm hoping to discover with you this week. Tomorrow we'll look at biblical and traditional narratives and what it might mean to kind of recast those from a different perspective, maybe looking at a story from the New Testament, from a character who's in the margins, who's marginalized, who's poor, doesn't have power or voice, and how we might relook at things. Wednesday we're gonna look at sacred poetry and kind of look at what, and poetry itself is an act of standing in the margins in some ways, because it often looks at things from kind of a non-traditional perspective. Thursday, we're going to talk about creative nonfiction, writing things from our own lives, our own stories. And then Friday, I'm going to share some things about being a songwriter and writing songs and what that's about. So I hope you'll join us for some other sessions. I love this quote from Gloria Anzaldúa. She's a scholar of Chicano cultural theory, very present person in the critical theory that was part of the programs that I studied in literature. But I love what she says about writing. She says, "By writing, I put order in the world. I give it a handle so I can grasp it. I write because life does not appease my appetite and hunger. I write to record what others erase when I speak, to rewrite what others have miswritten about me, about you, to become more intimate with myself and you, to discover myself, to preserve myself, to make myself, to achieve self-autonomy." So, anything about that that kind of sticks out at you when you look at that or think about it?
So, did you just speak up? Mm-hmm. Or, like, is this like a school
room? Speak up. I keep college students, I tell them, no, just talk. Please talk.
I don't know, what stuck out to me, and as we were just reading it before you presented the information, stuck out to other people, was I speak to rewrite what others have miswritten about me and about you. And then also, you know, I write to record what others erase when I speak. It's like at first when I read it, I thought, well, I write to record what others erase. And that's a very different meaning than what others erase when I speak. So I thought that was very interesting that that was connected. Yeah. That was one phrase.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Good. Well, I think writing to put order in the world, I think that's what especially a nonfiction writer does, is you order a concept or you order stories. We're all taught to outline as a first step. And I always tell people there's nothing magic about outlining. It's nothing more than a list.
Yeah.
And that list puts order
into
your stories.
Right. If you understand how the brain works, too, you need that handle. Because you've got to put some order, you've got to put it somewhere where you can go back and retrieve it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, so a lot of times it's a closet with a hanger, but here you've got a handle.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I saw.
It's puzzling. It's an interesting sentence. I write because life does not appease my appetites and hunger. I'm not sure what that means. Maybe that's something that we can, you know, this seems deep.
Unpack a little.
But I'm not sure I fully understand what she means by that.
That's the one that stuck out to me, too. And it made me think of the times I've read memoirs, the way that the plain old ordinary can be described with such amazing language that it doesn't seem so plain old ordinary.
Well, I think that in the phrase it speaks to something like being at Holden, because you may hunger for a way to describe the view, say, here. And if you can write well, or if you're reading what someone else has written well, that does help appease that hunger. I mean, so often you see something or hear something, and you think, if I could only capture this.
Mm-hmm. I've probably been to a Holden maybe a dozen times, and each time I hunger for that knowledge and closeness, and that draws me into a better understanding of my relationship with God.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, you know, I mean, it's just such a continuing process.
Well, as one who never hopes to write for others to read, I like the phrase that says to discover myself.
Yeah.
I, that's a reason I write.
Mm-hmm. I think, I mean, Gloria Anzaldúa would definitely articulate that for her, writing is a political act. It's a way of defining, describing, you know, making a statement. And how that, you know, who's impacted by that depends on who you are. But in some ways, you're constantly writing to do that. I'm going to transition. Thanks for your input on that. That's very Very nice. Well, the wonderful thing about teaching in any context is you always learn things from people that you're facilitating or sharing with. So some of you said things I hadn't thought about before. As a teaching staff, I have the opportunity to recommend a couple of books in the bookstore. And so I have two selections that are there. This one we're going to work from today. And I don't know if you are familiar with Parker Palmer. He's a Quaker and a Christian and a writer. And this book, this little book, Let Your Life Speak, is a lovely book about kind of finding your inner voice and coming to know yourself. And it's not written directly for writers, but I think that particularly if we're writing poetry or creative nonfiction, one of the first things we do is sort of listen to ourselves and kind of know ourselves. And this is a really lovely, lovely book. The other one, I'll flash this at you again on Wednesday when we do poetry, but is a book compiled by Lucy Shaw, who's a current poet and a Christian, and it's called A Winding Light, Poems of the Incarnation. And it's a series of lovely and very non-traditional poems that interpret the life of Jesus from his birth to his crucifixion. And really interesting takes on things and kind of new perspectives that I hadn't considered before. This is called A Widening Light.
A Widening.
Yeah. So, and they're both in the bookstore, right? There's kind of a section right in there, but you might want to peruse them and consider adding them to your collection. They're really nice. I just wanted to take a look together at the first couple of pages of Let Your Life Speak. And I only made 15 copies, so if we can share, that would be great. And if not, we can send my dad. Washingtonian, but I lived for several years in Oregon, and I'm thrilled that this book starts out with a poem by William Stafford, who's an Oregon poet. He was poet laureate many years ago, and this is one of my favorite poems of his, so I was delighted when it was in here. So we're just going to read the beginning and think a little bit about this in terms of being writers and what it means. So, sometime when the river is ice, ask me mistakes I have made. Ask me whether what I have done is my life. Others have come in their slow way, into my thought, and some have tried to help or to hurt. Ask me what difference their strongest love or hate has made. I would listen to what you say. You and I can turn and look at the silent river and wait. We know the current is there, hidden, and there are comings and goings from miles away that hold the stillness exactly before us. What the river says, that is what I say. Ask me whether what I have done is my life. For some, those words will be nonsense, nothing more than a poet's loose way with language and logic. Of course what I have done is my life. To what am I supposed to compare it? But for others, and I am one, the poet's words will be precise, piercing, and disquieting. They remind me of moments when it is clear, if I have eyes to see, that the life I am living is not the same as the life that wants to live in me. In those moments, I sometimes catch a glimpse of my true life, a life hidden like the river beneath the ice. And in the spirit of the poet, I wonder, what am I meant to do? Who am I meant to be? I was in my early 30s when I began literally to wake up to questions about my vocation. By all appearances, things were going well, but the soul does not put much stock in appearances. Seeking a path more purposeful than accumulating wealth, holding power, winning at competition, or securing a career, I had started to understand that it is indeed possible to live a life other than one's own. Fearful that I was doing just that, but uncertain about the deeper, truer life I sensed hidden inside me, uncertain whether it was real or trustworthy or within reach, I would snap awake in the middle of the night and stare for long hours at the ceiling. Then I ran across the old Quaker saying, "Let your life speak." I found those words encouraging, and I thought I understood what they meant. Let the highest truths and values guide you. Live up to those demanding standards in everything you do. Because I had heroes at the time who seemed to be doing exactly that, this exhortation had incarnate meaning for me. It meant living a life like that of Martin Luther King Jr. or Rosa Parks or Mahatma Gandhi or Dorothy Day, a life of high purpose. So I lined up the loftiest ideals I could find and set out to achieve them. The results were rarely admirable, often laughable, and sometimes grotesque, but always they were unreal, a distortion of my true self, as must be the case when one lives from the outside in, not the inside out. I had simply found a noble way to live a life that was not my own, a life spent imitating heroes instead of listening to my heart. Today, some 30 years later, "Let your life speak" means something else to me, a meaning faithful both to the ambiguity of those words and to the complexity of my own experience. Before you tell your life what you intend to do with it, listen for what it intends to do with you. Before you tell your life what truths and values you have decided to live up to, let your life tell you what truths you embody, what values you represent. Any comments on that passage?
Yeah, Ron.
For me, it's coming at a more recent stage in my life. I don't know, as a younger person, I was. Is there a developmental thing that goes with that?
I have no idea.
Some people catch on earlier than I do.
Yeah.
I guess I would say I'm just hearing to listen and let your life, rather than always be planning and organizing, structuring, mm-hmm. achieving, mm-hmm. all those things that your ambition somehow tells you to need to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I think when you come back to order, I think you have to decide at some point what values you are going to demonstrate in your life, and certainly we hope that what you're demonstrating is what you believe in. But we were having a conversation last night regarding parents who don't do a good job with their children. We were talking about a situation in a community where people just don't always do the best parenting, and I think that's a situation where you have to decide that there are certain things that are important to you, and you have to create those handles, if you will, so that those that what you do with your children demonstrates the values that you have determined are important. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think you can just live by your gut.
I like the image of the frozen river.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
Because to me, there's so much that I've experienced. Again, I agree with Rod. There's a sense of time and time passing in what I hear Parker Palmer talking about here. That sometimes you have to wait for the river to thaw, and you don't know when that's going to happen. And there's some experiences that will bring out certain parts of that hidden current that are like new births. They're surprises. I think my personal experience right now is grandkids. That has brought out aspects of me that I didn't know were there. And so I like that image that is portrayed there. It's also hopeful.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, and I'm not sure he's suggesting that for the duration of our life that we're not acting or setting or deciding, but that maybe there are seasons. That is, you're suggesting seasons of our lives where we do stop and think, or that somehow we get on this rat race in our culture that's driving us toward being something that we all sort of think we should be, mm-hmm. when really in each of us I mean, we're each different people with gifts that sort of match the world. Frederick Buechner has a quote that I love, and he says, the place that God calls you is the place that your deep joy and the world's deep need meet, or it's something.
Oh,
I just
want
to have that moment. And so somehow that there's this something about who we are inside of us that, that there's a kind of a right place for us.
A balance.
Yeah, yeah. So I, you know, I mean, we could get into, we could do a whole week session on vocation, right, and calling. And that's obviously not what this is. But I do think that people who write, all of you, you know, those of us when we sit down to write, that we do write from inside of us, whether we're writing fiction or nonfiction or poetry. And so kind of that consideration of who we are as people, what we're being called to be and do, and sometimes what... I have moments when I just have to say something, and I don't know why, but there's something that I just need to say, whether I blog it or write it somehow or write it in a song, that I'm just compelled, you know, by something inside me to say that, which I think is a lovely thing. So.
There's a hand over here.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I was just saying, I write because life does not appease my appetites and hunger. I think he kind of says that catching a glimpse of your true life, a life hidden beneath the river of ice.
Connection.
That, I think we're all in the same boat. You know, life circumstances and our situations sometimes put a damper on what we think is maybe our deeper calling.
Yeah.
And we have these appetites and hungers for things that are perhaps beyond what we can achieve right now. You know, we have a small child, and we were talking today about self-actualizing. I said, I can't do that right now. I'm not self-actualizing. You know, because I'm helping my son to self-actualize.
Right.
And he's the most important thing.
Yeah.
And he was saying, well, can't you do both? And I said, well, I don't know. My mother didn't, so I'm doing what my mother did for me. But being here at Holden is a little piece of that for me. But I kind of think we do have appetites and hungers that we can't always feed them because other people need us.
That's great.
I guess in regards to that, what I thought about, I didn't even think about this until you said that, but when you're talking about appetites and hungers, and when I think of the river and the fact that you can see to it and that you can see it, and so what stuck out to me and I find a very important part of my faith, the fact that I can challenge my own faith, that my faith is something that I grow by being upset with it. It's something that, it's not stagnant, it's growing. So when they were talking about, but for others, I'm the one, the poet's words will be penetrating, piercing, and disquieting.
Mm-hmm.
That was, in a way, even though it's a sense of being uncomfortable, that is something that makes me comfortable with my faith. And so when I thought of like the river, and the fact that asked me about this, you know, point out to me that I have to wait, that this is something that maybe I didn't plan for, that maybe I did plan for, but I'm still unhappy with this stagnant moment where I'm waiting, but at least I'm aware of that, and that helps me really understand, like, later on, it's like, well, I misinterpreted it, but now I look at it, and I go, yeah, I really misinterpreted that, but guess where it led me to.
I love that when I stare at 18-year-olds with this kind of stuff, they sort of look at me, you know, all this wonderful life wisdom and this conversation. It's wonderful. Any other, I don't want to cut anybody off. Anything else?
Well, I think you made a good point when you used the word compulsion, and that comes back to not appeasing appetites and hunger. And certainly for those of us who have been preoccupied with young children, the compulsions they are not met. Those hungers to write, for example, can often not be met. Or if perhaps you are writing for work and cannot write to satisfy hungers.
Right.
But I think compulsion is a good word.
And I think even being able to identify that those hungers are there. I mean, I'm going to put Aaron on the spot, who just finished a doctoral program and who loves to hike and be in the mountains. And for 5 years, that was kind of on the back shelf, but that never went away. That hunger and knowing that you needed to appease that appetite was something that would come back around, you know. So certainly. Let's can we talk about this word margins for a minute? Because I'd love to unpack this a little bit. When we talk about, particularly if we're talking about standing in the margins, writing in the margins, what are some of the spaces in our lives, the places in our lives that we might consider marginal spaces out of which we might write?
Well, not to answer that question, but the reason I was drawn to this class, writing margins, is I never write in the margins.
Oh,
to me, that's, you know, not something you do. That messes up the book.
Sacred.
But I have a friend, when I get a book from her, I just go in all the margins.
Yeah.
And his friend I'm drawn to because she's just flowing over with life.
Yeah.
And I think that's what, you know, causes her to write in the margins. She's just overflowing with thoughts and ideas.
Yeah.
And I love that about her.
Yeah.
So when I saw this, I thought, I want to hear what, you know, somebody who does write in the margins, how they think about life.
Well, to cite you an example of books where there's marginal writings in a far more prosaic way, The Dummy's Guides. The way A Dummy's Guide is laid out with the pull-out comments and what we would call sidebars, that is really a form of marginal writing. You have the main text, and then you have these warnings and extras.
So I'm not a biblical scholar, but from what I know, from the canonization process and a lot of the books of the Bible, were obviously handwritten. And so, as what I know, and you could maybe Ron or someone else who's more into that could weigh in, but they would the scribes would copy the text, and then there would be notes that would be added to the margins. And then when someone else recopied that text, those marginal notes would get put into the text. So there are parts of scripture that are thought to actually be not from the primary writer of the book, but to be notes from. So it's interesting the way that even things written in the margins become part of kind of a central narrative or story, which is what we all hope happens, right? I mean, when we write from those marginal spaces, we hope that that has some validity and that those stories become part of the canon of the writing of our world.
I think of the marginal writing and kind of in the context you're talking about is, as you're reading something, what are the thoughts that those writings are triggering, so that it's more than you have. Oftentimes there's a concept that's being presented, but our brains are so good at linking experiences and other kinds of things, and so marginal writing to me is, what are the notes that I write to myself as I'm reading something that this thing uncovers or I like your word, Emery, unpacks.
Well, and in both ways, I mean, the practical things like warnings, but then again, speaking of what your friend, it probably adds, is her enthusiasm, say, for a particular passage.
Right.
Or question. She'll question what the writer said.
Or perhaps she will relate it to something that two of you shared.
Yellow highlighting and underlining, is that all part of marginal?
Yeah.
Marginal
yeah.
writing?
Yeah.
I can't read without highlighting. You know, I'd like us to, though, consider also kind of the etymology of the word marginalized, right?
See, that doesn't sound right. That's not a good word.
It's not a good word. No, it's not a good word. And I think that sometimes the margins, you have such positive thoughts about what margins are, but to me, when things are marginalized, they're pushed aside. They're things that we don't see as important. That kind of our main ideology or our main narrative, you know, they're things outside of that. And I think as writers, that's a really powerful place to start from, is to write about the things that our culture marginalizes, that we push, yeah.
Or even our own identity. You know, I mean, if I read something, it's usually because someone has recommended it or something of value. So what I might think about that probably isn't of much value because it's not the written word.
Right.
And so I'll write something that I probably wouldn't want to share. You know, I might not pass that book along.
Yeah. It's interesting that those books get passed.
Yeah. confident.
Yeah.
That's what I would think. A neighbor just last night gave me the book, Who Moved My Cheese? and probably people have read it, but it's about change.
Huh.
And the biggest thing about change, or resisting change, is fear. So when I was thinking about that, I'd probably be writing about, this week at least, about a little bit of my own fears.
Yeah.
And those are things I probably wouldn't want to share. So that would be marginal list.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think loss and grief and shame, I think these are things that exist in the margins of who we are. And that because of fear or because of whatever that is, that we are reluctant to write about that. Sometimes because who wants to hear about our sad day, right? Or who wants to hear that? But I think there's ways to sort of tell those stories, you know? Times when we didn't have power, writing from a position where we don't have a lot of power, which is what Anzal Dua, I mean, she's, you know, Chicano cultural theory, trying to raise up this culture of people who for a long time didn't have much voice, kind of in the midst of this political movement. What are some other spaces in our lives that are marginalized? Can you think of other things besides these?
I just think politics marginalizes. I think that especially in our current day, though I think it's always existed, the ideologies that do not allow conversation or dialogue. They force a way of thinking and deny anyone who doesn't think that way. And it's on all perspectives on the continuum. It's not just one.
Yeah. You know, along that line too, I would say our religion would be, because in our family, I'm the eldest of seven, and I'm the religious one, and I don't know. Gosh, I don't know what they think, what that means to those other people. My sister's a lawyer.
Yeah.
That's a good point, because in today's politically correct environment, you know, in the effort to be inclusive, we end up almost being exclusive. You know, it's like the school programs where you cannot mention Christ in a song, you know, and every holiday celebration has to have a Kwanzaa song that's made up and doesn't mention Jewish. You have Kwanzaa and then you have something for the Jewish holidays, but it doesn't mention Jewish. It's just, what is it? Happy Hanukkah.
Yeah.
It's some goofy refrain that little kids sing.
My own journey has been thinking about how, as a species, we've sort of marginalized the rest of creation and, and become so focused on ourselves. Even in Christianity, a friend of mine calls this diva theology. And the world's paying a price for our misbehavior, God's creation.
Yeah. I guess the other point I just wanted to make before we're going to look at a couple of just short pieces of writing and then give you a little bit of time to write on your own. I also like to think that we have the power or the ability to step into the margins and be with other people who are there. So I'm white, I'm educated, economically, I'm surviving, right? So I'm kind of, you know, kind of down a central road. But that doesn't mean that as a writer, there are times when maybe it's not my own loss, grief, shame, but that I can align myself in those marginal spaces and write from those places alongside someone, use the power that I might have, the central text, you know, of my voice. Also, so that I think that's another thing to add to that. To that list. Sometimes I think marginal spaces in our lives are just places where we're disillusioned or we're confused or where we feel lost. doesn't even have to be some, you know, big, a death or something significant like that, but every day we feel those things. So here are just two short places where I think we see some of this kind of good writing happening. There's, you know, I made 15 copies. You know, if you don't consider yourself a writer, I want to encourage you that you are. That the act of picking up a pen and paper makes you, or a computer, or however you write, makes you a writer. And that you don't have to set out to write a novel or some sort of big thing to be a writer, but there's so many lovely pieces of writing that are just short and that we read and sort of think about. So the first is from Kathleen Norris. You maybe are familiar with her. She's a poet. She and her husband lived in New York City for many years and were sort of living the very hip New York City poet life. And then her grandmother, who lived in South Dakota, passed away, and she had the opportunity to move with her husband to South Dakota and to kind of pursue her writing there. And she stumbled upon her grandmother's faith in this small Presbyterian church in South Dakota. And anyway, it sort of was really a kind of interesting shift in her life. So she, this is from a book called Dakota, Spiritual Geography. And she does these little weather reports, and they're about, they kind of look at different things going on. So, somebody else want to read this? Just a different voice? Anyone?
Sure.
Okay, thanks.
When my third snail died, the little girl writes, sitting halfway in, halfway out of her desk, one leg swinging in the air, I said, I'm through with snails. She sits up to let me pass down the aisle, visiting poet, working with the third grade, in this dying school, this dying town. We are writing about our lives. I'm hungry, looking forward to the lefse I brought for lunch at the Norwegian Food Festival, sponsored by the Senior Citizen Center, one of the few busy places on Main Street. That and the post office, the cafe, the grocery. The other buildings are empty. The teacher's writing, too. Yesterday she told me that when I asked the kids to make silence and the room was suddenly quiet, she thought of her mother. She's been dead for years, she said. Adding almost apologetically, I don't know why I thought of her, but then I just had to write. She told me about the smells, how this time of year the lingering scent of pickling spices in the house would gradually give way to cinnamon, peppermint, cloves, the smells of Christmas baking. It was the candy I loved most, she wrote, not fudge, caramels, divinity. The sunsets here have been extraordinary, blazing up like distant fire in the window of the old boarding house where the school has put me. Last night I was reading when the light changed. I looked up and gasped at the intensity of color, a slash of gold and scarlet on the long scribble of horizon. I was reading one of the old ones who said, "One who keeps death before his eyes conquers despair." This little girl calls me, holding up her paper for me to read. When my third snail died, I said, I'm through with snails. But I didn't mean it.
Okay. So flip it over. On the other side is a piece. I'm sorry, I didn't write this down. There's a literary journal that has just been taken up by Whitworth University in Spokane. It's a Presbyterian college. It's where I went to school. And they have this lovely publication called Rock and Sling, and it's all kind of reinterpreting, reimagining faith through poetry and prose. And this is one of the pieces that came from the winter episode or issue of that. So how about another reader? Kat, would you read? Thank you.
Sure. I was in the 10th grade when it first registered. I will be someone else someday. Late afternoon, in the car with my mother, I corrected her on a point of geography that I'd seen written on the chalkboard that morning. She had learned that at some point, she said, but had since forgotten. How could she forget something like that, I wondered. I waited for her to explain. I received no explanation. I thought, if she can forget, I can too. 2 decades later, I fail to remember that I will be someone else. Not just someday, but next year, next week, next day, next anything. This forgetting is not a failure. Constant awareness of everlasting change is too much weight for any man to bear. Yet without such knowledge, without occasional remembrance, that discovery is possible, I would grow self-sick and homesick enough to seek the sting of self-destruction. My first real kiss took place in a hallway in the 10th grade. In the moment, I was terrified. I wished to death to be back in geography class, where I knew what lay between points A and Z. After she kissed me, C said, "You know, we won't always be together." Several times since, I have been with someone only to think, "I am with you now, but someday I won't be." So strange. Sadness at the as the cost of discovery. It will not always be like this.
So if we had 2 hours to meet, we would take some time to talk about these two pieces and think how, in some ways, these writers are both writing in the margins, and also reflecting people around them who are in the margins, perhaps. I would love to give you some time for, it's going to be short, maybe 10 minutes, to pick up a pen and paper and just try your hand at writing something. If you need a place to begin, perhaps you could consider a way that you stand in the margins, or that someone you know stands in the margins. And if we just want to start writing, and then when we have 7 or 8 minutes left, I'll stop you. And if anyone is willing to share what they've written, knowing it's just a beginning, a scribbling down, a first draft, it would be wonderful to hear some of that. So I have, some of you have pens and paper. I brought some paper and some pens. I can pass out to you if you need one. All right, how brave are you? Anyone willing to? There's obviously no obligation. I will not call. It would be wonderful if one or two or three of you felt compelled. Yay, Carrie!
I had some shame, I think it was last week. Okay. So this is entitled, I'm sorry if I take a long shot.
It's all right.
So this is entitled Ken. Last week I met Ken. No, he does not look like the Ken of a Barbie Ken. In fact, he does not resemble that image in any way. I was watering my garden around 8 o'clock in the evening, dusk in New Jersey in the summertime, when I saw a tall African man walking up my quiet one-way road, and I thought to myself, I've never seen him in our neighborhood before, and because it was growing dark out, because I live a half mile from some not-so-safe neighborhood in Newark and South Orange, and because I'm ashamed to admit, a small part of me still connects danger with the black men in my community, okay, the world. And because I was home alone, I was initially scared and concerned. Ken stopped, turned off his cell phone, and called a hello over my somewhat noisy hose. I reciprocated the hello, and before I knew it, he was firing friendly questions after friendly question at me over the hose, which I think was my security blanket. I asked too, "Where are you from?" Hi again, strangely.
Great.
Sorry.
That's okay.
Oh, shamefully assumed Newark. But Ken casually said, "Africa." What do you know? Any countries? Where? Do you know any countries in Africa?
Yes.
Yes. Name them. Huh. I rattled off 2 or 3 and happened to name his. As I write, it escapes me now. Kenya, perhaps. Ken has been in the state over
only three months
and lives 3 doors down from me with his aunt. Not
pronounced
aunt. And uncle. Ken surprised me that night.
Thanks, Carrie. Yeah, we do. We write from sensitive places, right? From their hearts. Mm-hmm. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
Can you tell us your name?
Carolyn.
Carolyn, okay. Thank you.
This is about my son. And I think sometimes children are marginalized, although our son is rarely marginalized. We try and he doesn't let us. His name is Mason and we call him BZ sometimes. BZ's victory is complete, my husband jokingly said, as he slid our sleeping son onto the far side of the queen-size bed. I chuckled as he pulled the covers up around his chin and placed his stuffed animals tenderly about him. It was true. Earlier that day, as we arrived in our humble accommodations, Mason had boldly proclaimed that he would be sleeping in the master bed and that Mommy and Daddy would share the twin. I felt loved and safe in that moment. My husband, acquiescing to my request that I not have to sleep against the wall where all the spiders are, slid Mason over and made a space for me to crawl in. Without another word, he slid into the twin bed. Hmm. Mason has had his victory, and it was a sweet one.
Hmm. We have time for a couple more, way in the back, and then our friend at the margin. Mm-hmm. Tell us your name.
Name is Bill.
Okay,
Bill. This takes place at the juncture of elementary school and junior high.
Okay.
It's
a marginal place.
Dinner was over. Dad headed to the garage. Lois to her room and the phone. Ron to his dart game. Mom to the dishes. Me? It was time for my nightly dialogue. Getting ready for junior high was on my mind. So was my guide, a seventh grader named Steve. He was wise. Plus, he smoked. Down the paved street, I hauled, glad it was still light. There he was, sitting on the curb of Northwest 49th and Chartel. Our curb, right over the gutter. The conversation started from a distance, right where we left off last night. What was junior high? How hard was it to make friends? How about the football team? Which fraternity should I join? Were girls really interesting? No talk of book learning, teachers, homework, grades. That topic had no place in a final summer after elementary school. Rather, it was time to relish big men talk. Explore the world of Oklahoma guys who had to make a name for themselves at Harding Junior High.
Thank you, Bill. Mm-hmm. We have time for one more. Do you want to read? Can you tell us your name?
Oh, I'm Deb.
Deb, okay.
Well, my friend writes in the margins. Every book I've ever been lent by her has notes and comments and questions in the margins. Mm-hmm. She's a stay-at-home mom, but one whose only child is now grown and working outside the home. Society looks at her, and I admit that even I, her friend, have looked at her, this lovely person, and wondered why she does not find a job. Heavens knows they need the money. They struggle from month to month. If you are not working outside the home, you have questionable value in this American society of ours. But she's being true to herself. She is searching for who she is after being a daughter, a wife, and a mother. She is taking time to find her voice, to read, to reach out, to write in the margins, to share the joy and the sorrow and the questions of her life. Someday her daughter and those who come after her will read those notes and get a glimpse of who she was. But will those I leave behind, what will they know of me? I have left only blank pages.
Well,
I just wonder how these people can finish. Mine is left hanging. Maybe some of you know that my husband has dementia. He is here with me. I think that if we had, if I hadn't had to plan this trip in January, in order to, I'm one of the forerunners, and they told us that we need to register in January. I probably would not have come, but I'm glad that I'm here.
Yeah.
But anyway, I didn't finish, but maybe I'll read what I have.
Would you read?
Yeah.
I am in a place that I never imagined. My script was written, my career over, my children are grown, they have families of their own. Now, my husband and I will do together some of the things on what has been called our bucket list. We have some time left, our health concerns are minor, manageable. We will write a new chapter. But life had another idea. I had told life what I intended to do with it and did not listen to what it intended to do with me. That's all
lovely.
I got.
That's lovely.
Well, I would encourage you to keep writing. I love listening to writing, so if you need to just read yours out loud tomorrow or some other tonight to somebody, please come find me. I would love to sit and hear you the piece you wrote. But I encourage you to come think about these things and to come back to other sessions. We'll be doing some writing in each of them. And thank you for, I mean, it's risky to write something and read it for people. So thank you for those of you who read for taking that risk, and those of you who wrote for even just taking the risk of putting pen on paper, because that is always a risk. Looking forward to seeing you again, and thanks for being here.